Oh, Radio 191 FM podcast? Nice one.
We're going to have a chat with two of my favourite academics from the University of Otago about the screening of this new documentary, a screening of a documentary called Israelism. I think this corridor is going to get pretty heavy because we're talking about the invasion of Palestine and I guess a lot of the really depressing shit about that, so maybe tune out for the next 15 minutes if you don't want to hear about that. But good morning, David and Olivier. How are you both doing this morning?
Morena, doing great. Honored.
I'm sorry, I think I need to... Is that better?
We are
there
here.
There you go. Morena. The microphone's working now. Fantastic.
And I am here. Is that still working? Do I
You're all good. I just forget that this microphone in front of me exists because it's kind of a new addition to the studio.
New addition, like Bobby Brown.
I'll say yes. but we're here to talk about this new documentary. Well, not new documentary, I keep saying that. The documentary called Israelism, which focuses on two American Jews and their experience in kind of deconstructing their identity and how, I guess, Jewishness relates to Israeliness, and they begin to really question Zionism. How did you all come across this film, and why do you think it matters?
Well, listen, if I might jump in first here. I think this matters in our context in Aotearoa, New Zealand. There's not necessarily an awareness of the richness and complexity of different Jewish traditions and the kind of real tumult that's happening inside the Jewish community. A lot of it sort of on a sort of generational split, and that's the story that Simone Zimmerman is talking about. She's trying to bring into relief the birthright and the propaganda system that tries to win over young Jews to Zionism, and how that's breaking down. And we've seen that play out in university campuses across the U.S., which has then seen really incredible crackdowns and repressions from the state and legal mechanisms to in a sense, criminalize Palestinian solidarity speech. We've seen the formal acknowledgement that basically the U.S. Constitution's First Amendment is now subservient to this extremely controversial definition of anti-Semitism put out by the IHRA, which basically says criticisms of Israel are anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. We've seen in my own little backyard in the U.S., in Virginia, a local community college, Piedmont Community College, screened this documentary film and as a result lost all of its city funding for doing that. And it was really shocking because the language is very legalistic. It's not like sort of like a MAGA cartoonishly evil thing. It's like, no, this is working its way into the legal codes. Australian universities just yesterday adopted what I would call a diet IHRA definition, so that Australian campuses will be cracking down on Palestinian solidarity and making academic freedom in that regard impossible. The Australian Jewish Council, again, which is an organization that, how to put it, I guess is on my side of the Jewish identity divide, has denounced this. So this is a film that's a real flashpoint for our democracies, let alone whatever strife inside the Jewish community and this broader question of Israel and genocide.
And you, David, what do you think this film matters?
So from a more general point of view, there's this tendency, I think of Israel as this kind of freakishly evil country. Mm-hmm. And I think there's this, and so what we see through Simone Zimmerman's story is this coming to a kind of moral reckoning with the way in which she has been essentially indoctrinated with and the connecting of her Judaism to Israel. Mm-hmm. But that moral reckoning, I think, is a general thing that I'm from the UK. We have never had a reckoning with our role when it comes to empire and slavery. That has never happened. There's never been any kind of truth and reconciliation commission. There has never been any kind of engagement through our education curricula with those kinds of that kind of history, right? It's always you come to school dressed up in as a chimney sweep, and you talk about the glory. And you talk about the glory of Queen Victoria, right? Mm. And so, I think when we look at Israelism I think we need to think about a broader kind of moral reckoning that's going on with people like Zimmerman, and she's taking that kind of journey. But there's a far greater need for a far more expansive set of moral reckonings across different nations. And, you know, I think whatever else has happened, that kind of the clarity of what the world is and kind of what it's structured around is a necessary condition for moving forward with this.
And that's why we see so many European governments that are pot kettle committed to this and ready to tear apart the International Criminal Courts and International Court of Justice for Israel.
It's pretty unfortunate stuff, really. This next question may seem pretty inflammatory, but I think it's necessary. Some say it's pretty disgusting to compare Israel to Nazi Germany for obvious reasons. I believe that when you kill 50,000 people in the space of about a year, you lose the right to complain about being compared to that society. Does Israeli propaganda, which torridly reinforces Zionism, differ at all to the propaganda from Nazi Germany about protecting the fatherland and securing Lebensraum? Or living space?
Here's how I'll answer that, Zach. And I think, the thing about Nazi comparisons and what is fascism today is, you know, these are products of a particular historical, modern, the context of modernity and the context of the struggle against communism. And so there might be similarities, there might be differences, because we live in a sort of world where there's not a kind of countervailing force against Western capitalism, really. But here's what I would instruct people to do. Is if you go back and read Winston Churchill writing in, I forget which, not the Daily Telegraph, but some British journal of repute, and he says, look, the Jewish, the struggle for civilization is in the fate of the Jewish people. And in the Jewish people, we see the scourge and the satanic evil of communism that must be eradicated, that threatens our European nations. But there is an alternative way. There is a path forward for redemption for these noble little mysterious people. I mean, it's insanely anti-Semitic. And he says that solution is Israel. Okay, so when you read Churchill and you read Hitler's views about Judeo-Bolshevism, it's really hard to distinguish the two. I mean, that's so at a certain, Israel as an entity says, look, we're not welcome in Europe, and we're going to, in Europeans' history of anti-Semitism, we're going to go settle that score somewhere else. So that's the sort of like a product of the structural anti-Semitism of Europe. In terms of the last 15, 16 months, what we've seen, how harrowing that's been, you mentioned Lebensraum. Now, Operation Barbarossa, which was, for those who don't know, was this disastrous invasion of Eastern Europe and all the way through Belarus and the rest, and eventually led to Russia. I mean, led to 20 million Russian dead, but it eventually led to the end of Hitler's regime. In Belarus, which was really, there's a harrowing film, Come and See, it really kind of captures this, where Belarus was a free fire zone. You know, anything that lived or moved was to be demolished and destroyed. Now, it's from a point of military doctrine, what happened to northern Gaza echoes this eerily. And look, the other thing too is we are in this really new realm of like a TikTok genocide and new sort of cartoonish, grotesque ways of inflicting sort of psychological damage where we're really seeing this, you know. So I guess that's where the sort of people want to make the analogy, because your eyes are sort of, we're plumbing the depths of what humanity's capable of here. But also, you say the Lebensraum question, if you look at the so-called ceasefire with Lebanon, Israel is refusing to retreat. What's the name of the river? Anyway, they're basically saying, look, we're going to hold this territory. They've also announced to the Syrian government that they will not allow the new Syrian government to advance troops below south of Damascus. They're taking Mount Hermon. So these borders are incredibly fluid. And you see this when Trump talks about his Gaza plan. He's like, you know, look, if we're talking about Israel, it's a crumb, it's a speck on my desk, and you've got all this land. He's really sort of articulating that, like, they should have a right to land. And it should. Why are we talking about borders and international law and all the thing that states are supposed to do? So, look, the catalog of insane genocidal rhetoric coming from the media, and governmental classes. You know, look, that's it's all there as evidence before the ICC and ICJ for genocidal intent. So I understand why people make that analogy, but you know, I'm an academic, so it's always the historical particularities are interesting. So I will emphasize those. But look, I would say the Israel Nazi flags don't help anybody in the cause, and you shouldn't bring those flags or do those kinds of tags. And that goes for you too, Kanye.
Ah, Kanye.
So I think ultimately it's a rhetorical question, right? It's whether you are trying to who you're trying to convince of your argument, and whether that's the best way to do it. But I do not buy the argument that as soon as you raise the comparison with the Nazis, that you've kind of given up on the argument. There's a way in which you're trying to push people to think about the harrowing quality of what's happening. So I think, generally speaking, a lot of those are, I agree with Olivia, not the most useful kind of as a rhetorical strategy. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a useful mechanism for kind of getting people to work their moral machinery. Mm-hmm.
And like you were saying with Belarus, eerily similar to what's happening today in a lot of ways.
And actually, you know, the crazy thing about that film, Come and See, was that that was Belarus for 18 months straight, which is interesting when you think about what Gaza has endured for what period of time. And it's also interesting, too. Sorry to keep harping on about this, but like, we tell a particular story about the Holocaust, my people, which says, you know, quote, we went like lambs to the slaughter, never again. That's the sort of cause to adopt a sort of muscular Zionism that will conquer and everything else. But like, there's a history of the Minsk Forest Brigades and partisans that were like socialists and communists who were part of like glorious struggle against the Nazis. But we never tell that story, right? Because it's structurally related to the anti-Semitism, anti-communism that is latent in Europe. So we must tell the Zionist nationalist story, not the kind of, you know, my favorite, Jean-Pierre Melville, who's Jewish, my favorite French film director, who's part of the resistance. Like, we don't tell these sorts of stories because we don't want to acknowledge the history of communism and socialism on the European continent.
Wow, didn't know about that. But I recently watched the film A Real Pain, where they kind of...
I rage quit that film.
Yeah, yeah. You rage quit it.
I rage quit it.
Oh, damn.
Because look, man, fake news, disinfo... No, I don't... Anyway, when Kieran Culkin's talking about, oh, yeah, we're in the Warsaw Ghetto, we're fighting the Nazis and the communists. Like, look, you can say that there is a stain. There are many stains on Stalin's legacy. Mm-hmm. There are many stains.
All
but
right.
The red...
Spicy.
Yeah. Very controversial. But... there was a military calculation that they could not support the Warsaw Uprising as they were trying to clear out the Nazis from Belarus. Now, that's been sort of like rewritten into the history for the sort of Polish nationalist cause, for the Zionist cause, for Holocaust remembrance as we think about it today as sort of historical fact. But it's the record is actually much more contested. But it does this – it very much plays this line of here's why our national project has to be is you know, here's why Zionism becomes the outgrowth of what Warsaw was, right, rather than this much more complex history that Europe still hasn't grappled with because the people that were in charge in these – you know, after – World War II were had some unsavory relationships with, let's just say, Nazi Germany. So there we go.
Mm-hmm. Moving on to, talking about the film, a decent amount of documentary seems to be touching on how attitudes about Zionism seem to be changing in Israel, and you were saying before it's a generational split, and this change is definitely coming from young Jews. Are those changing mindsets about Zionism manifesting in political action?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's obviously this protest movement of the last 15 months is one of the largest things we've ever seen since, you know, the Vietnam campus protests. And we're talking about students at Columbia University who are America's cream of the crop, would-be elite.
Well, I guess I mean within Israel itself.
Oh, unfortunately, no.
Oh.
If you look, for instance, I guess one signal would be how many people are refusing to serve in the IDF at this point, and the numbers are vanishingly small. So I think generally speaking, if you look at the overall support that the military interventions and occupation, I think those moves are coming from within Israel, which I think ultimately, and this is why this film is important, or at least the story it's telling, is what is 85% of Jews across the world live in either Israel or America. Mm-hmm. So the moral revolution, and so Chomsky talks about this in the context of Vietnam, but there has to be, there's no one that could move the American empire other than the Americans themselves, right? Vietnam maybe is...
Or China.
Or China. Well, yeah. Okay. Spicy. But there needs to be a moral revolution within these places in order to get them to shift, right? Because the red lines don't exist for them unless they're kind of self-imposed. And so I think that's something that needs to be taken seriously, is that when you have a country like Israel that is committed in this kind of deep, you know, structural way, where 10% of its GDP is put towards the military, to give some context, in the US it's about 4%. You have a country that is committed in ways which are very hard to extricate oneself from to a particular kind of project. So no, those shifts do not seem to be happening, and what little glimmers there are quite easy to fluff out.
And if I might, Zach, you know, we're a TAGO staff for Palestine. We believe in boycott, divestment, and sanction of the State of Israel, because we believe that there's not really the potential for meaningful engagement with civil society. It's not like their resistance, our resistance, will lead to structural change. And the example that I gave to University Institutional Neutrality Panel was that the publisher of Haaretz magazine, and Haaretz is like, or newspaper, is like the cream of the crop of sort of liberal intelligentsia newspapers. Like, they're the best of what, let's just say, Israel civil society journalism has to offer. And their publisher gave a speech last October in London saying, look, it's a genocide. The only way to meaningfully do anything is to boycott. We must have truth and reconciliation out the other side of this. And the response of the current Israeli government was to draft a law. The Minister for Justice told the Attorney General to draft a law which says that any Israeli citizen calling for this boycott and sanctioning of Israel should face a 10-year sentence that would be doubled under times of war. Mm. So this is the structure of that state, and unfortunately the weakness of something like Haaretz to sort of stand athwart that state. So that's why the outside maximum pressure needs to be brought to bear.
And that's why people should go see this film, Israelism, next Wednesday at 7 p.m. at St. David One Lecture Theatre. I will be attending. I want to thank both of you for your time and coming on the program today. Coming up very shortly, we have Stu Patterson from the Adelaide-based band Empty Threats coming through to talk about their new single, Phone Call. Do both of you have any final words you want to leave the listeners with?
You know, not often I'm stuck for words, but it's a pleasure to be in the stew. Yeah, as always, Zach.
That's good having you both on. I'm sure it won't be the last time.
Cheers.
Take care. Because I think that, you know, Netanyahu is a horrible, horrible person, I think this song by Leonard Cohen does a great job of communicating that vibe. So here is The Butcher by Leonard Cohen. We'll have a chat with Stu very shortly. Stay tuned.
You're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. Find audio like this online at r1.co.nz or wherever quality podcasts congregate.